coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
I like to tell my clients that they're going to go on a round trip ticket. They're going to go on a journey. That I remind them that the safety profile of ketamine is incredibly high. They're safe. They're safe. And the intention is, yes, for them to come back a little bit different. And the intention is for them to come back a little bit more themselves. And I think that being able to leave the default, being able to leave the body for this time to journey in whatever way happens, allows a person to come back with more softness, allows a person to come back with more kindness. And to be literally like, I mean, I had a session this afternoon and a client really wanted my hand on her for most of the session. And so I'm happy to do that. And she wanted it on her shoulder, then she wanted it on her chest, and she, you know, cued me at different points. And then she said, okay, you can leave me. So beautiful. I mean, I could cry.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a weekly conversation series with leaders in psychedelic culture, designed for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts. Presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. Today, I'm speaking to Lauren Taus, a licensed psychotherapist and a yoga and meditation teacher based in Venice Beach, California. In addition to modalities like cognitive behavioral therapy, family systems work, mindfulness, and somatic techniques, she also offers ketamine-assisted psychotherapy when she feels that it's appropriate for her clients. On the show, we discuss Lauren's background with MAPS MDMA protocols and the tutelage of her mentor, Phil Wolfson, author of the Ketamine Papers. We talk about equal access for psychedelic medicine and her advice for young practitioners. Lauren also has her own podcast called Embodied Life with guests such as Rick Doblin, Rachel Yehuda, Camille Barton, and others. And so we share a few podcasting tips on the show as well. So prepare for a journey and may we all return with a little more softness.
I'm ready. Let's party. I want to play.
You want to play?
Yeah.
Why? This isn't the play podcast. This is the one for grown-ups.
You know what? Life should be fun.
Life should be fun.
And I actually have a lot of clients whose breakthroughs with psychedelic medicine revolve around experiences of pleasure and play. So it's actually kind of a real thing.
Okay, explain that. What is it about pleasure and play that causes a breakthrough in someone's life?
People are conditioned in many ways in this culture to wear badges of honor around life being hard. And there's also so much efforting around what a good life is supposed to look like, what it means to be good. And my experience is that people actually like aren't having that much fun. Even in the places where you'd expect or anticipate fun, like there's quite a lot of pain. So for someone to experience in their bodies, in their hearts, in their minds, playfulness and joy, relief, it's significant. It's actually quite profound.
So Lauren, thank you for coming on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. It's a great pleasure to have you here. And I'm grateful that I just had the opportunity to be on your podcast, the Embodied Life Podcast. And so we're going to talk today about psychedelic therapy and about bringing joy and making people happy. And one of the things that I want to talk about with you today is how one crafts a business of supporting people. And what are the different pieces that go into play around creating a livelihood in this work, around being a healer in a way that also satisfies and serves our own lives. And part of why I'm choosing that theme with you is because I'm really impressed by what you've done with your coaching practice, with your podcast, and then also with the ketamine-assisted therapy. It seems like you have a whole sort of comprehensive way of touching people's lives, serving them in certain ways, small ways, maybe with the podcast, and then kind of bringing them into a healing environment with you. And I think for many of the people listening, they'd love to model something like that. They'd be able to do something where they're able to connect with not just clients generally or drum up business or whatever, but to have a whole ethos that's present in how they express that they're available to be healers in the world.
Fabulous. I'm super excited. And just as a point of distinction, I am also a psychotherapist. I'm licensed clinically in both New York State and California State, which allows me to work with psychedelics in a way that isn't available for most coaches, if you will. And I think that may be a variable that changes in time, and I hope that it does. But I, for over a decade, have had a clinical license that lives in two different jurisdictions, which has been supportive for me in, it's been my permission slip to do this work above board. I have my master's in social work from NYU. That program is very clinical. So immediately you're working with clients within a context of psychotherapy. Upon graduating, you need to complete 3,000 hours of clinically supervised hours to sit for a state board. So I did that. And much later on, I learned with MAPS in their MDMA assisted therapy protocol for complex PTSD, and then have also trained and am still, you know, receiving mentorship from Phil Wolfson, who wrote the ketamine papers. So he's really my like ketamine go-to. And I'm as well part of a consortium of clinicians who are actively working with ketamine, because with many of these things, we're really in the wild, wild west, and there aren't quite a lot of protocols that are clear, and people are in phases of exploration, both within research and with education. Like, there aren't a lot of established models that have been proven, you know, effective. I mean, obviously, I have a training for medicine that isn't legal yet.
Yeah, it's a prescribed off-label. Is that the... Oh, no, you have the training in the MDMA, which is not legal, and then the ketamine is prescribed off-label for depression.
Correct.
Whew, so, yeah. Close there. Totally messed it up. You know, Lauren, this is a fun interview because, like, we're friends. Yeah. And so I'm feeling kind of a lot of playful energy. And then you also are, like, very dialed in your work. And so it's an interesting... I feel like I'm like doing that pendulation into the seriousness and then into the joyful, playful energy, which isn't typical for this podcast. So let's start at the beginning of your journey with psychedelics. And I love that you kind of set the table for the whole conversation by talking about a reclamation of joy and play, and that there's a kind of a wake up to, whoa, I don't have to live these stories that are unhelpful to me, that life is supposed to be hard, that I'm not allowed to be happy, that I don't deserve things, and that psychedelics kind of blow that wide open. I'm curious about your first experiences with psychedelics and how, when you first arrived at the understanding that psychedelics could be so potent as a healing modality.
Wow, it's fun to go back there in memory space. My first psychedelic experience was with my brother, who had been journeying for a while, and I was scared. I would say in all of my client sessions, even with the people who are regularly working with a ketamine-assisted psychotherapy protocol, where ketamine is a tool in the treatment that I do with them, people are nervous to let go and to be in the space of the unknown. And I mean, I'm still nervous whenever I'm exploring consciousness in that way. So I just want to name that fear is normal. And a very healthy part of any sort of process, I think. And for me, my first experience was with my brother, and it was immediately healing. It was immediately healing. I didn't know that would be a factor in my work. I wasn't present to psychedelic medicine at that time. I didn't know that it could be in the same conversation with psychotherapy, although it was happening, I just wasn't privy to it. So in my first journey, immediately I received uploads. I received what may be called a download. I like to call it an upload. It's in reference to struggles that I have had with my body, in struggles that I've had with my parents. I often go biblical in my psychedelic journeys, and a lot of biblical stuff. And for those of you who don't know me, I've spent a lot of time in the Holy Land. I feel very connected to the biblical story. It's a story like any other. But I had visuals of caravans and people marching from my mind into my heart. And that journey from head to heart and kind of arriving in my body in a new way. So my first experiences were profound out the gate. They were also intentional. They were within the context of ceremony, and they were familial as well. So I, in that kind of container, continued to journey with my brother, who is also a ketamine therapist. And we both work with my dad, which is another fun story that I think is cool to tell and to name.
You have worked with your father in the context of giving your father ketamine-assisted therapy, or what do you mean?
Yes, and.
Okay.
Yes, and. My father is my primary prescribing physician in my practice.
Ah, okay. So he is the prescribing physician for the ketamine. But were you just alluding to the fact that you have given him psychotherapy?
I haven't given my dad psychotherapy. No, that would be completely inappropriate. However,
I was going to say, that seems like a lot might get in the way if you tried to do that.
But I did sit with him on medicine in his first experience with psychedelics. Hmm.
How was that?
I gave the man life. I gave the man a whole new life. In his 70s, and you know, I'm currently putting together a pretty impressive panel with a group of other people for the online Burning Man, for the multiverse. And our collective, we're called the K-Dome, you know, Ketamine Dome. And one of the panel conversations is coming out of the psychedelic closet. And that will be one that includes my father and a number of other individuals. And the work of destigmatization and education that I'm also deeply committed to in this space. So my father, after his first experience, wanted to work with me in this way. And I was like a whole body, yes, cool, let's do it. And, you know, since my brother has trained in this type of work and works in Los Angeles as well as a ketamine assisted psychotherapist, ancillary to his traditional psychotherapy practice. For me, my practice is predominantly psychedelic, although I only use ketamine or any other kind of psychedelic as a tool. Like it's a treatment. It's not a solution. It's not the panacea. Like let's be very clear about that.
And how long have you been working with clients with ketamine?
I have been working with ketamine for about a year.
And at what point did you do the MAPS MDMA protocol?
They were very close to each other, my trainings. And in fact, when I started working with ketamine, or even thought about working with ketamine, I had a real sour taste in my mouth because I had a lot of judgment about ketamine.
Because it's a party drug? I mean,
not only is it a party drug, but it's a drug that can very easily be used as escapism, as a powerful mechanism for departure. And I'm working actively to be out of the conversation around good and bad. That being said, as an individual in party environments, watching people actively pursue a K-hole and seeing what that looked like scared me and made me very uncomfortable. Like one of the questions that I want for any psychonaut to be asking themselves, and okay, whatever your answer is, but are you engaging with whatever compound this is as a way to leave or as an invitation to really excavate inner space, to be in discovery, to heal, to grow, to evolve, right? And when that is the intention, not surprisingly, that's when people are more nervous.
Mm. So you had a bit of, you were a bit tenuous about potentially working with ketamine. It sounds like your whole perspective on judgment of good and bad has shifted. But was there a moment when you saw ketamine work in a particularly efficacious way and you're like, okay, I see this. This is real medicine and this really makes a difference?
Absolutely. In my training, so ketamine as a legal medicine, I went to the ketamine training because it's a legal medicine. That's why.
And this is Wolfson's ketamine training?
That's correct.
I'm familiar with him, but I'm not aware of the trainings that he does.
Yeah. So he is my teacher and he is one of the, I think pioneering practitioners with ketamine. And I mean, he wrote the ketamine papers, which is one of the kind of the Bibles for this type of work, which is as well a compilation of other doctors, PhDs, et cetera, who've been engaging with this substance. So I went to the training because ketamine is legal. And I'm like, well, let me like relax my snobbery and go find out more. And relax my judgment specifically. Within the context of the training, each practitioner, each student will have two experiences of their own. And then that allows for each participant to witness 56, in my training, for example, different integration experiences. So what
56.
Yeah, we were 28 students.
Oh, so you're witnessing in other people their experience of integration.
Yeah. So you yourself will have two of your own ketamine experiences, and it gives you kind of a real visceral sense of what this medicine is and how it works. And then on top of that, you're going to have the ability to witness what presents for others in a very rich way, in a real way, in real time. So I wasn't reading out of a book anymore. I was watching people process repressed memory. I was watching people access different parts of themselves. I was watching people convene with the divine, and I was sold. I was like, this is an amazing, amazing tool.
And you were talking earlier about a substance that makes you go away or a substance that makes you more present. I think ketamine's an interesting one with that because it is a dissociative. It is a bit of a trickster in the medicine family in that it is the only psychedelic that's actually physiologically addictive, which is a pretty interesting thing considering you can't really get addicted to LSD or to psilocybin mushrooms, but you can get addicted to ketamine. And a lot of people are using it recreationally. So it seems like it can be this really potent medicine, but it can also equally be abused.
Totally. And the question about escaping or going in, I want everyone to ask for any psychedelic experience that they're going to have or for any sort of like consciousness shifting experience, including with alcohol, right? Are you using to leave? Are you trying to get out of here? Are you trying to go deeper inward? I'm against the nasal spray personally.
Why is that?
Because it's so fast acting and it can be really intense. You can take a lot of it and you can get out fast. I work with the lozenges and with intramuscular injections. None of my clients flirt with any type of abuse with this compound. Those of my clients who I've supported during COVID through telehealth, none of them have used this without being on a call with me, without being, really observed. And there's a lot of safety precautions that I've taken in advance of those sessions. For example, to ensure that somebody is in the space or available should they need it. But the medical kind of safety checks have also been done in advance. And, the way that I look at ketamine is it is a dissociative anesthetic. My mother actually worked with it in hospitals. And I like that fact. And it really allows the body to go into a deep space and place of rest while activating like the mind and spirit. So people have deeply, deeply spiritual moments with ketamine. And that's really, really beautiful. Like that's a gift.
And these moments of spiritual transformation and openness and surrender, is the client taking the size of a dose that would be in a recreational setting called a K-hole? I mean, is it that level of dissociation?
So a clinician can work with ketamine a number of different ways within the context of therapy. For example, someone might take a very small dose, which would facilitate and allow for anxiolytic therapy, meaning the amount of ketamine is so small that it's almost like just a social lubricant and allows a person to open up more comfortably, speak more with greater ease around whatever it is that's present for the individual. I tend to work in higher doses to create a trance-like state. And, you know, when someone comes to me and we decide at a certain point to invite the tool of ketamine, I'll start with a lozenge to titrate for the individual sensitivity to the medication. And from there, we'll move on to an injection in a subsequent session. I want a person to really kind of drift into what might be, you know, the K-hole, we call it transformational space. And I believe deeply that the relationship is as important an ingredient for the success of the treatment as the medicine. And I also like to encourage people to really be in a space of deeply, deeply knowing and trusting the facilitator or the clinician in such a way that they would, you know, trust them with their life. Like, you are talking about profound levels of consciousness that deserve a lot of care and attention. For me, I don't like the at-home protocols as much, even though teachers of mine use it. I really want to be personally able to tend to that like rich, fecund, fertile space that avails in the immediate aftermath. In cases where somebody might be struggling with like very, very heavy anxiety or depression, I might encourage it just because the need to disrupt ordinary mind is so much more acute and it is cumulative, the medicine. So a person needs to kind of shatter those default mechanisms in a pretty consistent fashion in order to awaken mind and realign the internal environment in a good way. But I really believe in this work being relational.
You spoke about building trust and the primacy of the relationship in the therapy that you're doing. How do you go about building that trust with a client? And how long do you take working with a client before you together would decide that ketamine would be an important ally in the work you're doing?
A lot of people come to me specifically for ketamine. And, you know, I would say a minimum of two sessions, and that's going to require that there be a very solid, quick rapport that's cultivated between me and the individual. I mean, I'd like to have 3 to 4. And there's certain people that come to me for ketamine, and it's like, no, that's not appropriate. I don't want to do that. Client selection for a clinician, I think, is very important for like a therapist to know who they can connect with and support.
And is that just about your personal connection with that individual, or are there any sort of red flags or any kind of like onboarding process you do to understand whether you want to take on a client to do this work?
I have my traditional onboarding work, and I do still work as a psychotherapist with a number of clients who are not working with me in medicine. I also do integration work for people who have all different types of psychedelic experiences. For me, there is something about an energetic connection that is present or not, you know, and I get to work with it and cultivate it and lean into it. But I kind of just know when it's time. And, you know, you get more and more of your own style and your own sense of doing and being in the space with medicine as you progress in the work. I feel totally present when I'm working, especially with medicine. I'm very at ease You know, I know my human Lauren can sometimes want to like posture and talk about how cool my work is and like all the different like research things that I'm part of or people I'm working with. But when I'm working, like I'm just there with the client. I'm just present and they feel me and I feel them. And it's like, we're working together. It's all on them. Like it's all about the client when we're working. And I'm fully there with my client. And it's a gift and a privilege and an honor. And I don't take it lightly. And the work works. It just works. It works particularly well to disrupt treatment-resistant depression and anxiety. It's also really a beautiful way to begin unfolding some heavy traumas. There's exciting research around ketamine and eating disorders, ketamine and postpartum depression for lactating mothers. There's tremendous, tremendous evidence around the power of ketamine to support end-of-life care, to treat suicidality. And I believe that ketamine is also just a really beautiful tool when worked with in a good way for personal and spiritual development and evolution.
How do you know when a client of yours is done working with ketamine? Is this an ongoing thing where they, you know, they have a treatment and it helps for a certain amount of time and then they need a new one? Or is it, you know, they do a certain amount of sessions with you and then they're done, or you're just kind of feeling it out? What is really the full client journey for working with you? I mean, sure, it depends. I'm sure it depends on the client, but generally.
Definitely depends. I'd like to prescribe 4 to 6 treatments. I try to keep them close in time. So ideally it's weekly for that space of time. There are people who don't need that as regularly and who just really want this as a way to support them in their deepening and then their growth. People who are really struggling, like I said, I'm going to try and get them in twice a week. People will, again, because the medicine works cumulatively, and when something is coming to me when an individual is coming with heavy, heavy treatment resistant depression or anxiety, like they're going to just need more disruption. And I believe that, you know, the dissociative part of ketamine, I like to tell my clients that they're going to go on a round trip ticket. They're going to go on a journey that I remind them that the safety profile of ketamine is incredibly high. They're safe. They're safe. And the intention is, yes, for them to come back a little bit different. And the intention is for them to come back a little bit more themselves. And I think that being able to leave the default, being able to leave the body for this time to journey in whatever way happens, allows a person to come back with more softness, allows a person to come back with more kindness. And to be literally like, I mean, I had a session this afternoon and the client really wanted my hand on her for most of the session. And so I'm happy to do that. And she wanted it on her shoulder, then she wanted it on her chest, and she, you know, cued me at different points. And then she said, okay, you can leave me. So beautiful. I mean, I could cry. I mean, I do a lot. But I know when it's time for them to kind of pause, and a lot of clients will then come back, you know, for a tune-up, to re-invite this spark, this kind of reorg, this aligning of internal tectonic plates. Thoreau says, become an expert in home cosmography. 1,000 regions of the mind yet unexplored.
That's really beautiful. I want to talk a little bit about your podcast. Cool. Why did you decide to start doing a podcast focusing on psychedelics?
I have a a twofold intention with my work. On the one hand, I'm committed to being in the space of direct service, meaning working one-on-one with clients, meaning learning myself. I am my top client. You know, I believe in ever unfolding and evolving and growing. And I want to be doing that in relationship and utilizing my tools and training and thousands of hours of work in this way. I also recognize that I'm porous, and it's not always easy to dislodge the content that isn't mine. And I never want compassion fatigue. I never want my heart not to break. And I also am on a pretty serious mission in this lifetime to support the larger movement of mental health. My mother was a complex trauma case who received lots of expensive treatment, which I believe re-traumatized her. My beautiful, beautiful, mystical mama, she was such a divine creature, died before she had the opportunity to work with any of this type of medicine. And I do this work in her name and in the name of the people who are suffering due to life experiences that I know can be well treated and effectively treated with this type of medicine. And I just know that this stuff works. I think the biggest problems on planet Earth are global warming and mental health, and psychedelic medicine with mental health provides the type of healing that nothing else can. So my podcast is in homage to that. It's a way to provide education and information, to share the wisdom, the work of my friends, of the people that I admire, who I have privilege to talk to and connect with in this platform in this way. And it's fun. Like, it's cool. I'm so stoked about the people that I get to talk to and the stories that I get to uplift. And yeah, it's part of the second prong. So all of the work that I do personally or within my practice is in service of a bigger goal that I hope will be impactful for the whole planet and mental health.
I love that. How long ago did you start the podcast?
The podcast is, so the psychedelic version is season 2, and I started that in COVID, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems recent. And you've had Rick Doblin on. You've had a couple of heavy hitters on your podcast kind of out the gate. That's quite strong move.
I've had some serious rock stars on the podcast, like serious heroes. Rick, who's since been like a mentor to me. I mean, he writes back to every email. Even if I get an away message, it's like I have a response from him within an hour. And I just want to like say thank you, Rick Doblin, because I know you're a busy man. You know, Louis Schwartzberg, Rachel Yehuda, Shannon Lee, I could go on. Natalie Ginsberg, Marcelo Talora, Phil Wolfson, of course, Camille Barton. It's a pretty strong collection of people who I consider real influencers.
You know, when I was thinking about your podcast, I was thinking about it in the context of marketing. And I like that your response is just not about that at all. I was thinking like, well, you've got this amazing practice, but then you also have this podcast, and I'm sure that the podcast helps create opportunities to work with new people. And I was kind of thinking about it a little bit in the context of sort of marketing, which I mean, ultimately really like community building, but community building in a way that kind of feeds your practice. But it doesn't seem like you conceptualize it that way at all.
I really don't. Like, I have a following that I built on social media because of my yoga life. And I feel like my following on social media is on some level confused. And definitely the like, what is going on? All these psychedelics. And to be honest, my yoga practice was psychedelic for me. And I think it's so important to remember that psychedelic is the nature of life. We're constantly mind manifesting. We're constantly unfolding. It's like, you don't need to ingest something to have a psychedelic experience. Breath is the first and one of the most powerful psychedelics that exists. This isn't just about like taking medicine. I don't really know what I'm doing with social media. You know, I offer my podcast as education. For me, it's been a really exciting way to continue to network in the space. and to meet people that I admire and celebrate them. It's been I've certainly gotten some clients from that work, but my intention is really to provide education, information, inspiration, and to offer it for free.
How do you get most of your clients? Where do most of your clients arrive from?
I would say that the majority of my clients come from word of mouth. That being said, I get a number of clients from Psychology Today. I have a little profile over there. The Psychedelic Directory. Some people come to me through my podcast. Some people come to me through Instagram. And, you know, predominantly, I'm someone that someone's heard about and is curious about alternative treatments.
What advice would you give to a burgeoning psychedelic therapist in terms of building a practice? And it seems like, as I listen to your story, it seems like there's these wonderful opportunities, these, you know, lions in the field who are giving you their time, being on the podcast, you know, these trainings that you're doing. It seems like you've done a pretty masterful job at drawing opportunity towards you. And it sounds like as well that you're not really hurting for clients at the moment. People want to work with you. You have a reputation. So with that in mind, I'm sure that there are some folks who are listening who would like to cultivate that for themselves. I wonder what advice you might give to those people.
Honestly, one of the biggest lessons that I've gotten is to trust myself, is to let myself lead myself. Once you do that, it just becomes really easy. So if you're interested in doing this work, A, understand that it's not so glamorous. Like, you're going to sometimes deal with people puking, and you're going to deal with people's, like, you know, most painful moments. And if you've got a heart, and I believe that you do, it's going to hurt you to hear. And that's something I'm still working on. Like, I'm still working on how to protect myself, because I need to be able to do that in order to serve well. And if you want to do it, and if this is your purpose and this is your calling, go fucking figure it out and do it. Ask questions. Listen to the people that, like, you admire. Go take a class. Psychedelics Today has tons of, like, great, great classes. Read the books. At this point, if you want to legally work with medicine, you're going to have to be licensed in some sort of, like, psychotherapy context. And that's going to take you a long time. That being said, the models within MAPS are widening to include all types of different practitioners. And there are different ways to be in the space. Like, you can make it up. Have fun with it. Back to fun. You know, you can sit with your friends and show up for them in a good way. Be in the space of listening and holding, and you can have honest, transparent conversations with your family members. Be in this space. Be in this space as you are. And then that's the gift.
You mentioned a moment ago, read the books.
Yeah.
What are the books that we should all be reading?
Wow.
The Ketamine Papers.
I love the Ketamine Papers. Cosmic Serpent, I highly recommend. Stan Groff's Psychonaut. I'm blanking on it. There's so many.
The Way of the Psychonaut. Was that the new one?
Yeah. The Way of the Psychonaut is a dense textbook. The Cosmic Serpent is from an anthropologist talking about the ways in which psychedelic medicine has produced all kinds of fields of knowledge from shamanistic cultures. I mean, my house is full of them. Chris Bache's book on LSD is great. And I like to work predominantly with the modern molecules. I kind of want to just name that too. The ones of my own culture, like, even as a yoga teacher, I taught within my, like, LA Jewish girl, like, my name is Lauren context. And so I work with the medicines that are from my culture. That's not to say that I don't want to learn. In fact, I'm learning actively from a woman who works mostly with ayahuasca. I don't have any intention to serve that medicine ever, but just to learn about more, like, earth-based ritual, communicating with, like, the your pelvis type of vibe versus, like, your mind and your words. And also just books on mindfulness. Psychedelics are a tool in my mind, to help excavate authenticity, exfoliate defense, and bring you back to yourself in a good way. So that can happen with meditation or yoga or whatever. It just gets accelerated in an exponential fashion when you're working with psychedelics well.
There's an issue in psychedelic medicine that really matters a lot to me, and that's around equal access. So if psychedelics allow us to heal exponentially, to level up in so many ways, or, you know, beef up creatively, it gives such a leg up in so many ways, and these medicines are prohibitively expensive for many people. How are you as a ketamine healer thinking about equal access to these medicines? Because ultimately, if these are medicines that allow us to level up that are only available to those well-resourced, then they're going to be an agent of widening inequality.
I'm thinking about it a lot. I have a number of cases that I see pro bono.
What's the balance of that? Because that seems to be the model that most people I speak to are, that, you know, like Sage Institute, for example. Are you familiar with Sage Institute mm-hmm. in the Bay Area? Mm-hmm. So for the listener, Irina Alexander, who's one of the founders, was on this show in one of our first episodes. And the Sage Institute actually has one aspect of it is entirely about equal access and training therapists from different backgrounds and seeing clients from different backgrounds. And then they also have another arm of the clinic that is for profit and that actually kind of balances out. And I think a lot of individual practitioners are doing the same thing. It sounds like that's kind of how you're balancing this.
Yeah, that's one part of the equation. I've been making my podcast for free, like doing things like that. And doing my best also to create partnerships with BIPOC people. For example, on my podcast this week, I interviewed Dre and Charlotte from the Sabina Project, which is a Black-led initiative on psychedelic ceremonies, integration sessions, education, information. They actually just launched their mutual ceremony fund, which I contributed generously to. And that is an effort to create resources for people who don't have resources to have these types of experiences. I am certainly looking to partner with clinicians of color to explore how to be in service to communities that are underprivileged, which are in many ways communities of color in this country. And I am deeply in the process of unpacking whatever internalized racism I have and trying to stay out of shame in that journey, because it's not useful for me or the movement or anybody else. I'm also conscious of the fact that there's a deep level of distrust in the BIPOC community towards white people, which is fair and due. And so it's a one marble at a time type approach. Brene Brown talks about building trust in that way. And what the medical system has done to the Black body is something that, you know, my white body might on a nervous system level trigger in someone. So it's a very complicated kind of question. And, you know, I don't want to be some sort of like white savior coming in to drop ketamine to communities that I don't know. I do want to cultivate connection, relationship, partnership, offering in a good way. And that's a question that I'm asking myself daily. And I feel I have a lot of room for improvement and also a space, you know, I mean, when I'm part of calls and I'm part of many different calls and many different like ketamine practitioner communities and psychedelic communities, it's like I'm often naming that it's all white. Everyone understands and recognizes that that's a problem. For the multiverse, I'm also putting together panels on anti-racism and transformative justice and psychedelics, decriminalization conversations. And there's one which I will be present in, and it is going to be facilitated by two women of color, where it's for people of color to share their experiences and for white presenting people to be quiet and to listen and hold space.
very appropriately, this is on all of our minds. And psychedelic medicine is a unique case in terms of its potential for inclusivity, its potential for getting it wrong, and how high the stakes are to get it right. I feel that psychedelics are, by their very nature, they're subversive. They're socially and politically subversive, and that's part of their healing power. It's not just about healing the client and they have a depression and they want that depression to go away. It's like, when you awaken to an oceanic oneness in a psychedelic state, you make some different choices about your diet. You make some different choices about the way you're going to take care of people around you. And I see that as the true medicine of psychedelics is actually within our culture, within our species, you know? And so it's so important that we bring everybody along for the ride and that we do the deep and important work to provide the safety necessary for all people, especially people who've been harmed over a long period of time, for all people to come and feel the safety necessary for that psychedelic experience to really allow them to open up.
Absolutely. And safety is such an important measure. And that's also cultivated over time. So like I said, I don't jump into medicine with anybody ever. I believe too that the sort of sense of oneness, the healing that avails happens within, you know, you think if you want to change the world, like start at home. And the story that I tell myself is that people are behaving the way that they're behaving because they're really at war with themselves. And people are engaged in all kinds of inner violence. And then that shows up in the outside world, of course. So I almost wanted to write a book called Piece by Piece, P-E-A by P-I-E. And it's like gathering all of these different pieces and making peace with them and like letting them be there. So I also, it's a tricky conversation, but I'm aware and always have been aware of the violence in perpetrators and obviously like the inner violence, right? Like what's happening here? So I also have that kind of mindset and outlook towards people in positions of power. Like, what are you doing? How are you so blindly like doing what you're doing? And I'm wondering, like, you know, what's going on inside? How, in what ways are you feeling bankrupt? In what ways do you feel like the need to hold on so deeply that so many other people are hurting? So yes, this work works well beyond the individual and in such a way that it offers deep, deep, deep medicine and healing for the collective. I like to say that the individual healing belongs to the collective.
Yeah, I've definitely found that to be true, in particularly in ceremonial contexts, that traditional indigenous forms of medicine use were most frequently group experiences, from what I understand, rarely individual experiences. And that when you're in a circle experiencing healing, it can be quite profound. Someone can be doing all sorts of deep traumatic work deep work on trauma that you have no purchase on, and yet it triggers something in you that allows you to go a little bit deeper, trust a little bit more, and release a little bit more. Do you know of any organizations or outfits that are wanting to do ketamine therapy in more of a group context? Have you?
I've had conversations with other clinicians about it. I know some people are doing it. I don't know. I don't track what's going on as much with the larger kind of clinic model. I'm not really into it. my understanding is that a lot of these places also are just less mindful of the individual and their what's happening with them. I'm interested in exploring ketamine groups, partially to take the cost down and also to create that type of deeper connection. It's interesting because I do think that the model of one-on-one is probably more Western and like American maybe. And there's also a good need and space place for people to really get held and cared for like in a good way.
So you did the MAPS MDMA protocol and you're working with ketamine. Do you have a sense of what, and mainly focusing on those two, but maybe with some idea to some other different molecules that are out there and different modalities, do you feel like different medicines are appropriate to different psychological challenges? Or is it just about blasting someone into oceanic oneness? However you can do it, they're going to get the download and they're going to be fine. Do you think in the future it'll be something where it's like, oh, okay, you have a deep attachment wound, so we're going to do MDMA therapy with your partner so you can explore that. You have depression, so we'll do ketamine. Or, you know, is it starting to kind of divide in that way for you, or how are you feeling about different medicines?
Anybody who has a complex trauma history, I want to immediately kind of prepare them for an MDMA session. That's what I want to be able to do. And I look forward to being able to do that, fingers crossed, God willing, in 2022.
And why MDMA more than ketamine? What is it about MDMA that's so efficacious?
MDMA is a much more egoic-driven experience. You're going to be in contact with your own heart and your own body and your own mind in a way that's much more anchored in your personal narrative than with ketamine, for example. So what happens with MDMA in the context of an MDMA-assisted therapy session is that an individual is able to return to specific sites of injury, so where the trauma happened, without being so deeply dysregulated, without being in a fight, flight, freeze model. I mean, they're going to be able to go back there. And I like to imagine it as, my role is to sort of be the midwife in a way of like the kind of birthing process. But essentially, the person is in partnership with the therapist and the medicine, able to reconstitute themselves at the site of the injury, reimagine what happened, and ultimately to integrate the experience in a way that allows them to operate with more fullness and with a fullness that includes what happened, but doesn't overly focus on it. So MDMA is for me, like the number one go-to when we're dealing with complex trauma. And unfortunately, a lot of people are dealing with complex trauma. It's difficult within the context of therapy because it's such a long journey. It takes all day. It takes, you know, 6 to 8 hours. And that's harder to offer and replicate within a therapeutic context. That being said, in my mind, with the knowledge that I have, the experience that I have, the education, the training that I have, there's nothing that compares to MDMA for effective trauma treatment. I would probably want, personally, to, at the end of an MDMA session, add ketamine, such that whatever like uploads happen in the heart space are kind of locked into like the astral plane of like the cosmos, which ketamine opens a person to more readily. So like, let's get this like earthy thing, let's get this earthling healed and kind of heart-centered, and then let's take that like straight to God, if you will, whatever good orderly direction, whatever you kind of conceptualize as the divine.
That reminds me of the Crossroads protocol, Crossroads, a former Ibogaine clinic, where they do Ibogaine and then they'd followed up with 5-MeO-DMT. So it was like really embodied, quite arduous journeying with Ibogaine, and then this sort of like speed dating with God blast off into 5-MeO-DMT, described kind of similarly to what you've just said with the MDMA and the ketamine.
And I think that, I mean, and I've heard ketamine in this intramuscular doses likened to a 5-MeO experience. You know, I have one client who's a super psychonaut, has done, you know, all kinds of different ceremonies. And he's like, I never would have expected in my entire life that my most mystical, profound spiritual experience would be an injection of the blood on your couch in Venice Beach. It's like, so it is.
Lauren, I know you already, in a sense, went here earlier in the conversation, but I always like to end this podcast with giving you the opportunity to speak to directly to those aspiring to be psychedelic healers. We talked about it a little bit in the context of building a business, because that's something I wanted to touch base with you. But I just want to now, in this moment, as we come to the close of our conversation, just kind of open up the space for you to speak directly to anyone who is wanting to do this work and wanting to heal in this way.
You are needed. We want you stay in your own heart's questions. Know that there are many, many great teachers, but that you ultimately will have the answer for what the expression will be. Trust in that. Explore different books and articles and podcasts and talk to the people who are doing it. And go do it. Go do it. Your unique energetic signature is what will invite people in.
I love that.
I quickly populated a very full practice because I just, like I said, when I'm working, I'm just being, I'm just being, and it's the isness that allows people to relax. As a human being, I have plenty of efforting and humanness and all the stuff, but when I'm working, like I am just there and activating the tools that I've learned along the way. I've learned a lot of things, but it's just coming very naturally for me. And when those gates open for you, whomever you are, the people will come. Be you. That's the medicine. That's the real medicine.
Lauren, thank you. It's our hour together has flown by today. How can people follow you? How can people keep up with what you're doing? What's happening right now that people should have their eye on that you're involved in?
So you can follow me on Instagram at lauren.taus, T-A-U-S. You can follow me on my website, which I really love, embodiedlife.com. It includes the show notes and blog to my podcast, Embodied Life, which you can find on iTunes and on Spotify. I am also really excited about a burgeoning research project that I'm working on with Bill Wolfson and Jesse Gold from the Heroic Hearts Foundation. Jesse has historically worked to partner veterans with ayahuasca experiences and to fund those. I am currently working to pioneer a research project on veterans with ketamine and mindfulness. And the hope is to have locations in California, the East Coast, the middle of the country, the UK, and also in Israel. So we have the protocol, we're getting funding for it. And I'm really excited to get cracking on that and to provide deeper information around how to support some of the people who need some of the deepest healing. So really excited to be part of the research, really excited to like share the stories and to stay connected in all these different ways. And thank you for having me, Eamon. It's such a pleasure. I love the team at Maya. I'm on the council and yeah, I'm just grateful to share what I've lived and loved and learned, and I hope it's helpful.
Absolutely helpful. And I think the most helpful part of everything you've shared today from my perspective as the interviewer is just the enormous passion, joy, and certainty you bring to the power of this work, which I think is a big part of what helps your clients feel safe. And I think what inspires others to join in this burgeoning field of psychedelic healing. So I see you modeling that in a really beautiful way. Thank you.
Thank you. Yay. So fun.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed this show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.